Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Matthew Bates. He's an associate professor of theology at Quincy University there in Quincy, Illinois, right up there on the river north of St. Louis, I think it is. He's the author of a number of books and host a popular podcast that has kept me company and enthused, along with Matt Lynch and several others. It's entitled On Script. It is much to be recommended. He has a PhD from the University of Notre Dame, and he joins me today to talk about his recent book, Gospel Allegiance, What Faith in Jesus Misses for Salvation in Christ, published in 2019 by Brazos Press. Dr. Bates, thank you for joining us.
Hey, David. Thanks for welcoming me to the Stone Chapel.
Yeah, we got to get you down to the real stone. I mean, the real physical Stone Chapel at some point.
That'd be wonderful.
We'd love for you to see it. Hey, in the book, I love your book, by the way. It's terrific. It is really, for me, kind of a call to action as much as it is an academic book. It is that, but it's also more of a call to action in some ways. But in the book, you describe yourself as a theological mutt. Now, what do you mean? I think that was your term. I don't know if I made
it was. Yeah.
What do you mean by that? So that we can
I
get
originally
to know
had mongrel, you know, in there, a mongrel, and Brazos edited it out. I'm just teasing. No, I don't think that's true. Yes. I mean that I never have really had a strong denominational identity and have been shaped by lots of different traditions. I grew up in a non-denominational, really kind of probably hyper-fundamentalist, King James only sort of church. I had like Baptist leanings if it had any kind of affiliation, but they didn't even want to hang out with the Baptists, right? Because, yeah.
We were too liberal, probably.
That's right. Something, I guess. Yes, there was some problem. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what it was. Mm-hmm. But then from there, I went and studied at Whitworth University. I wasn't really doing theology at that time, although I took a couple classes, which had a Reformed ethos. And then from there to Regent College, which has a lot of Reformed influence, but also a lot of Anglican influence as well. Mm-hmm. And then from Regent College, then on to Notre Dame. And during the midst of that time, I also sojourned with the Mennonites for a while. I went to an EV Free church for a while, went to a Baptist church. So there's been a lot of different, you know, influences in my my background and my training. And the truth of the matter is I don't really strongly identify other than saying like church matters, right? I've always been a very pro-church guy. But on the other hand, I don't really have that strong denominational identity.
Yeah. I've grown to appreciate liturgy more and more as I've gotten older, which I think is probably, you know, not an unusual thing to happen, I guess. So what's the big idea behind your book? I tell students that every good book has a big idea that drives it. What's the driving big idea behind your book?
Yeah, there's really kind of two big ideas that marry together. The one big idea in the book would be that we slightly misunderstood what the gospel is. At least a lot of popular articulations and academic articulations, frankly, of what the gospel is, and that there's been a miscentering of the gospel or a misidentification of the climax of the gospel would be an even better way of putting it. And that in the New Testament, the gospel climaxes with the proclamation that Jesus is the King. And so obviously the cross is essential, the resurrection is essential, the incarnation is essential, all those things are essential to the gospel, but the energy lands at the end on Jesus's kingship. Yeah. And then as part of that, then the second big idea that marries with that idea is that we've also slightly misconstrued what it means to respond to the gospel fully. And we've talked a lot about faith in the church. Sometimes that's gotten like, you know, dumbed down to a kind of belief idea, unfortunately, and I think we're all aware of that danger. Mm-hmm. But it's usually just been articulated as a trust. The book is pushing and saying that's actually not quite enough. Like that when we're talking about responding to the gospel because Jesus is the King, it involves also loyalty and allegiance. So we're not denying trust, we're not denying belief, but we're also wanting to say faith includes loyalty and allegiance. So the big idea in the book is that Jesus has become the king, and the saving response to him is allegiance.
So there are a lot of false gospels out there. There have been false gospels since Paul wrote Galatians and probably before then. What are the nuanced false gospels that you're concerned about? I mean, today, what would you say those are?
Well, I mean, that's a huge and complicated question, because there's a lot of false gospels that like plague the world and creep into the church, right? But they're not really the target in my book. Like, I mean, we could like identify the big three, right? Of the idols of the world, you know, like power, sex, money, right? Those are the classic, you know, idols. And there's of course gospels that attend all that, right? That somehow if you get your sexuality right, or your sexual appearance right, well, then somehow you're going to end up with a flourishing life, or somehow if you can climb the ladder enough, right, you're going to end up with power that matters, or somehow if you just like roll the dice in the stock market correctly, your bank account's going to be flush and you're going to have this perfect life. Like those are classic false gospels, you know, and I hope we don't hear those in our churches, you know, of course, because the church is in the world and the world is in the church sometimes more often than we would like. I do think we do sometimes hear those messages in sort of mixed ways in our churches, but that's not really the target in the book. Like if I say, what was the target in terms of false gospels? False is probably too harsh of a word. Mm. It's probably better to say the target is like a reductionist idea about what the gospel is. The target is to say that like there's been this strong tendency in the church to reduce the gospel to the cross, and to say like, what really is the gospel all about? It's all about what happened at the cross. Oh, like, well, maybe, yeah, the resurrection too. Like, we'll kind of nod our head in that direction. It's the cross. And okay, I guess the resurrection, if you press me, right? But I'm not sure why, right? The church is oftentimes confused about why the resurrection might matter. But this book is trying to explode that myth and say that actually, like when we look at scripture does not speak that way about the gospel. The cross is essential, resurrection is essential, but they're essential partly as the path to how Jesus became king, right? And that we have to get that part in the gospel. We have to get the kingship part, because our like the things we want about the cross and resurrection, they don't come apart from Jesus's kingship. They come through it, right? We only get those benefits of the gospel through his kingship. So helping people to see this is not just about Jesus saved me. It's about the fact that the Christ, the king, in his royal capacity, he has to be the king who saves, because the king gives the benefits.
Yeah. When I was, I guess, years ago, learned the thing called the four spiritual laws. And the first spiritual law is God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, right? And it seems like that the thing that drives that the four spiritual laws was the plan of your life, that it's all about your life, God's plan for your life, realizing the plan for your life. Now, I realize there's a lot of self-interest there, but there was no reflection upon the fact that Jesus is king, and that I am a subject, and really my life ought to be lived out in terms of honoring the king. It was all about the plan of my life.
What was that? I'm just curious, what do you think the fruit of that was as you saw people kind of like evangelizing around those four spiritual laws? That Campus Crusades tool, I think, right?
I think it was,
What were the, and that's obviously a great organization. And
it
Cruz
is,
evolved,
absolutely.
Like Cruz, a lot different now than it was back then. But what do you think the fruit was as you saw that, right? Like as people were putting forward that as like the plan of salvation / gospel,
right.
What effect did that have in the church?
I think part of the thing, Matthew, that happened was the fact that it became about an individual rather than about the community itself. You know, the plan of my life is not necessarily the plan of your life, and we all have different plans and such. So I think it bred kind of an individualism within the church that, you know, and we're all individuals within a community, but there's a community aspect to what church means too, right? It's a gathering. It's the people. It's the community that really matters. So I think that was one of the problems that developed around there. I do think that it was a great tool, though, for people to be able to talk a little bit about the gospel, even if it was reduced a little bit or taken a little bit away from what, you know, the fullness of it. And I think what I hear you trying to say is, let's restore the fullness of the gospel. And that's why in a particular place you write, the true biblical gospel cannot change. And then you say the gospel must change. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that I mean that the gospel must change in our churches, obviously, as we're slightly misarticulating it. But I think you're right that that kind of parody of the gospel, right, that reduces it down to God's plan for your salvation, your personal salvation, right, like feeds right into American individualism and helps us it makes us unaware of like what God is doing through the gospel. In one place, Paul describes the gospel as the gospel of the glory of the Christ, the image of God. This is 2 Corinthians 4:4, if I've quoted it correctly, mm-hmm. right? That's an interesting and a potent way of speaking, right? We don't really think about the gospel as restoring the glory very often, right? Mm-hmm. And that part of the way the glory is restored is through Jesus as the one who is the glorious image of the Father that God plants in creation, that he places in creation so that we can gaze on him and so be transformed into his glory. Like we tend to think about salvation as something that we're saved from. Like we need to be saved from death and punishment and hell or however we want to talk about this.
Right.
And that's all true, right? We do need to be saved from those things. Mm. But like where the gospel has fallen short so often is a failure to talk about what we're saved for. And the way that I would understand some of that to work, right, is that it's about a community glory process, right? Like it's as my glory is restored as I gaze on the Christ and your glory is restored as you gaze on the Christ. Well, it's actually that glory, we're reflecting it to one another too. Mm-hmm. And there can be this kind of upward trajectory that we spiral upward in glory together. And that's why we need the church, among many other reasons, right? Is if I don't see the glory of God through you and you don't see it through me, neither of us are refreshed in our glory. Mm-hmm. So I think that, yeah, it's something that I actually don't touch on much in Gospel Allegiance, as I'm just riffing here.
Yeah.
But it's inspiring other stuff, which is what a good book does.
Yeah, and Ephesians 2, 5, and 8, Ephesians 2, 8, 9, and 10 figure very prominently, saved by grace through faith, and yet we are saved for those good works that you were describing, right?
Yeah.
So the connection, help us to understand from your perspective what the connection is between grace, faith, that is allegiance, and works.
Yeah, so I follow John Barclay quite closely in how I talk about grace as Barclay splits grace into these six different dimensions of grace, right? Mm-hmm. And wants to say that we've been talking past one another quite a bit because of misunderstandings about grace. And some of the most important misunderstandings would include the idea that grace is just something that God does, but that we don't need to respond to, like that it can only be purely gratuitous if in fact it doesn't demand some kind of response. And Barclay shows that that's actually not true in the New Testament at all, right? And that it does demand a response. And the response, I think, appropriately is allegiance or obedience. The New Testament speaks about it in both ways. So I think that like kind of correcting that and seeing that that grace actually empowers us, right? That grace rules, it reigns. So working on those kind of themes has been important to the book. One of the pressures I think that I wanted to push on is partly the language in the New Testament that tends to speak about the gospel itself as the key grace, right? And so when we see here words like for by grace you've been saved, right? We tend to like abstract that and push it into some timeless sphere. Right, like that God's grace is like this timeless quality that he gives. If we historicize it, I think we do better, right? If we see like by grace you've been saved, like the grace is actually the gospel gift itself, right? And Paul, as Paul's speaking about what grace means, he does speak about this in Ephesians 2:5. Like he already talks about what it means to speak about grace. He talks about being like events connected to the gospel itself, right? We're seated with him in the heavenly realms and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think that we want to be thoughtful about the connection between the gospel itself and grace. And then that obviously spills over into the faith works conversation as well.
Yeah. One of the things I like about what you did, and things I never really thought about, frankly, even though I've read the letter of Pliny to Trajan a number of times, you make the case that it's a good way to think about the issue. It's not really about what you believe. It's about your allegiance. It's about to whom you're loyal. Give us a little bit of, take us through that, if you would, a little bit about what's going on behind that text and how the word allegiance and loyalty sort of suggest themselves out of that language. Because the language of pist, or the language of faith, has been, I think, broadly misunderstood. E.J. Gupta has talked about that. Tracy Morgan, some others, have talked about that as well. But take us through that story of Pliny and Trajan, who's...
Yeah, so, well, Pliny was this governor in Bithynia, if I'm remembering right, which Asia Minor. Mm-hmm. He was troubled, right, because he was encountering these Christians in his sphere of influence, right? And so he writes to the Emperor Trajan asking for advice about what to do about these Christians. But in the meanwhile, right, the contagion's getting worse, right? These Christians are multiplying. So he's not sure what to do. So one of the things he does is he decides to put out this little test, right? And so what he does is he actually puts out a bunch of idols, and including among those idols is the Emperor Trajan's own statue, right? He puts a little image of the Emperor Trajan, and he asks them to perform an obeisance, like, to these images, right? And he says, well, I've heard that they won't do this, nor will they curse Christ. So I'm going to use this as my test to find out whether these people are really Christians or not. If they're real Christians, they're not going to give homage to the statues, nor are they going to curse Christ. So anyway, it's interesting that he uses this language, right? Why the Emperor Trajan statue was one of the things I think is interesting. Pliny seems to put a lot of emphasis on that, right? He seems to be wanting to say, like, I brought in the idols, right? And then he wants to say, including the idol of you, right? And that's the thing that's interesting. Now, it could be he's just sucking up to the emperor.
That's what I was thinking. He's just currying favor with the big man.
There's probably some of that, but you know. I think there's also more going on there, because the emperor is the one to whom ultimate allegiance is owed, right? And so a good, loyal citizen of the empire, right? They need to perform this duty of offering incense to the Caesar, or else they are not loyal. They're disloyal citizens, and then are worthy of punishment. So I think there's more going on. There's something about the inclusion of Trajan's statue that suggests there's an allegiance concern going on. So I use that as a way of kind of opening up the allegiance topic and kind of saying, hey, look, like, we see something very similar with pistis language when we move to Revelation, right? And we see something very similar going on with Jesus as the King of Kings, right? Mm-hmm. And concerns around pistis to him. And so I kind of draw some connection between Pliny and what we see in Revelation.
I really like that analogy, because it helped me sort of frame this notion of allegiance and loyalty. Mm. And I'm reading Tom Holland's book called Rubicon right now, which is all about allegiance, you know, all the allegiance that was ultimately given to the Caesar at that particular
time. Tom Holland is a fantastic writer. I haven't read Rubicon yet, but I read his Dynasty.
That's my next one. Dominion. Really, it's Dominion, right?
Dominion is the one that's the sequel to Dynasty.
Oh, see, I haven't seen that
one. Okay. And I haven't read Dominion yet either, but I keep hearing, like, read it. So he's just a fantastic writer. I mean, he can really, like, bring these ancient stories to life like none other.
I don't know how he does his research. It's phenomenal.
He's phenomenal. He's a phenomenal classicist on top of, like, I mean, I think he was a journalist by training, so I think he had sort of classics background. And
I think that's right.
So hey, he brings both that journalistic, you know, kind of sensibility to his writing, but combines it with some real, you know, some genuine expertise in the classics. Mm. So
let's do some pretty quick answers here just because of time. I pledge allegiance to the flag. Use the word allegiance. Can Christians do that? Should Christians do that? How does that...
I think that we have to be careful in terms of the context of doing that. I think if we're in a context where it's not clear that our ultimate allegiance is to Jesus, or that could be like a confusing thing for people, I think we're wise to just respectfully not pledge at that time. And I still think, though, in certain contexts we can, right? If we're in a company where people, like, we know people would understand that, like, I can give my allegiance to my country and I can give my highest allegiance to Jesus at the same time as the king. And those things aren't always in conflict, right? Like, most of the time they aren't, actually, I wouldn't think. Sometimes they are, right? Whenever if our country is doing something really awful and asking its citizens to participate, then of course, like the Christian must, in obedience to Jesus, say no.
Say no right? to that,
and,
right?
Yeah,
right.
We can't give allegiance. So I do think we have to be careful with allegiance ceremonies, and the church needs to use them, right? We need to capitalize on them. We need to create our own more powerful allegiance ceremonies, because how powerful is that to every kid who stands up there every day as they're, you know, 4 years old, you know, 20, you know, like pledging allegiance to the flag.
Yeah.
That creates a kind of identity that we need to capitalize on that energy for the church.
Good. Yeah. Interesting. Chapter 5, faith is body out. What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that faith is something that is a bodily activity that's relationally oriented. So that, like, we don't want to think of faith as purely mental. It certainly involves mental things, but those mental things are expressed outwardly in relationships. So I am drawing on Teresa Morgan's work, Peter Oakes's work. Nijay's book wasn't out yet when I wrote Gospel. Well, what I think when I wrote either of them, but I have read Nijay's book, and Nijay does some work that would reinforce this as well. He does some interesting work on covenants and on allegiance with loyalty in relationship to covenants, which I think is important. So all these conclusions together, I think, are pointing to the fact that faith is something that is relational and is something that is embodied. Like, we can't, we tend to be naive about these things because we tend to have a very strong mind-body dualism, right?
But yeah.
Like, we can't do anything without the aid of our body.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All of our interactions and all of our connections with everybody is through the body, right?
Yeah.
Reception of your book, how's it been received?
Really well overall. There has been some pushback a little bit in some circles, but nothing that would cause me to revise anything that I've written. I hope that doesn't sound arrogant, but I'm not that I'm not learning from people, but I don't think that there's been any challenges that have on a scholarly level pushed back in a way that I feel like demands a response.
Finally, what do you hope this book accomplishes? Like I said at the beginning, it seems like as much a call to action as it is.
Oh, yes. Yes.
What do you hope it accomplishes?
I think that the church needs Jesus as king. Like, we're lousy kings, right? We're lousy rulers of our own life, both in the individual sense and in the corporate sense, right? And that we need to give more space to Jesus's kingship. And I think that my greatest hope would be that this will bring together discipleship and our salvation theory in a more holistic way. So that people, whenever they are hearing the gospel, they realize what they're hearing is a call to give allegiance to a king. This is going to involve their bodies, right? Inescapably involve their bodies. Mm-hmm. There's no way to respond to this king that's going to be apart from the body and is just like a trusting mental action. Right. They are going to trust, like, as part of their mental activity, but it doesn't stop there, right?
Yeah.
It's not just believing Jesus died for my sins on the cross or trusting that what happened on the cross was effective.
Yeah.
Well, it was effective, but it's getting things backward. Like, the benefits flow through kingship. So we acknowledge Jesus as king. We give our loyalty to him. And one of the perks of his kingship is that we're forgiven, right? Like, we are forgiven people, that the whole community, the whole people of God that is being created around Jesus's kingship, that we are all participants in that. So it's something that, like, cuts the church out of the loop, right? If we're not careful, right? Like, it all becomes about me and Jesus. And instead it's about Jesus doing something for his whole people that we then get the opportunity to join into and get the benefits of.
Yeah.
So kingship has to come first. And when we get that backwards, when we make forgiveness come before kingship or we don't even get concerned with kingship, we've really fundamentally misunderstood the gospel. So my greatest hope is to see the church, like, fix that problem in its evangelism and its discipleship and its daily life, so that people are holistically responding to Jesus as the king and submitting their lives to him, including me, right?
Yeah,
I need
it
too.
Well, yeah, we all need that. I love that passage in Romans 12 is often preached on. I urge you to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice.
Yeah.
And the emphasis there is really on bodies, to present your bodies.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hands and eyes and feet and the whole of us, right? It's not just about
Absolutely.
Present your brain to God and let God and, you know, be in your head, you know, that kind of stuff. So anyway, we've been talking to Dr. Matthew Bates about his book, Gospel Allegiance, What Faith in Jesus Misses for Salvation in Christ, published in 2019 by Brazos Press. Dr. Bates, thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Thanks to Brent Johnson and Janet Seifert for editing these podcasts. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.